This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
For complete candidate statements and more information about all of your candidates for the local station board, please visit kpft.org. The future of KPFT and the entire Pacifica network now rests upon the participation of our listener members. This is KPFT Houston.
Good evening. This is the Monitor on KPFT in Houston. Of course, 89.5 FM in Galveston and kpft.org on the World Wide Web. If you're listening live here in Houston, then you know we're on 90.1 FM. What you may not know is that you can stream the show live at kpft.org, and you can also subscribe to an RSS feed and get your podcasting MP3 device to download the show automatically. So if you go to kpft.org, go to the archive page, and you'll find the Monitor on the list of shows there. They're listed alphabetically. This is Mark Ribari along with Otis McClay, and tonight we have a slightly unusual show for you because we are going to have a full team. Otis, I don't know if you remember way back when this show started, my partner in crime back then was Shannon Young, and she's going to be joining us tonight. She's on her way to the station. She'll be here in just a few minutes, and so instead of doing the usual sort of news summary and headlines section, we'll be talking to Shannon about what she's doing in Houston. She's tracing a story. Shannon, for those who don't know, used to be part of KPFT News. She was also part of the headline team at FSRN and is now a freelance journalist based in Mexico, and has been following a story that I think might interest a lot of Houstonians. It's a story that ties Houston with Mexico, with drugs, with human trafficking, with slavery, with the sex trade, and with a lot of other very interesting strings that you don't get to hear discussed an awful lot, at least. And they should be in Houston. We should know about all these things because we've got kind of the final port of destination for a lot of this stuff. So that'll be our first interview. Shannon Young will be here shortly. In fact, here she is walking in. And
Speak of the devil.
Speak of the devil. And right after Shannon, we'll have another live interview with John Dean. John Dean was a counsel to the President of the United States for 1,000 days, beginning in July 1970. At age 31, he was Chief Minority Counsel of the Judiciary Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives. This is, of course, during the Nixon White House. Just recently was a pretty big anniversary for the Pentagon Papers and Daniel Ellsberg. In fact, there's a new documentary that just came out that features Ellsberg and a lot of his work on the Pentagon Papers. Well, Dean was heavily involved in all of that and got to hear a lot of inside information about how the Nixon White House was functioning, what they were intending to do to Ellsberg, you know, breaking into his home, breaking into his psychiatrist's home, hanging him out to dry in the press. Which I guess you could kind of see some similarities between that and what the Bush team did to a certain ambassador who called into question what was happening in Iraq. Anyway, John has just re-released the paperback edition of his book, Blind Ambition. It's been updated. We'll talk to him about that. And we'll also talk to him about a couple of more recent news stories, including Tom Ridge's new book, which reveals some things which I think we suspected here for a long, long time. And that is political pressure being put on Homeland Security to manipulate the threat level. You remember the color codes and all of that stuff and how they jumped
the
various
points. I can't imagine that the Bush administration would do anything like that.
I'm sure we're imagining the whole thing. But you know, Tom Ridge confirmed some of it in his new book, which was interesting. And John, I watch him regularly. He's a pretty frequent guest on Keith Olbermann's show, Countdown, and I watch him there. And every time I watch him and I hear him say something really interesting, I email him. And he's kind enough to respond. And today he's going to be kind enough to talk to us about it. And rounding out the show, as I said, it's a busy show, we have Andy Bickelbaum of the Yes Men. If you haven't heard of them, then do yourself a favor. Get online and go to theyesmenfixtheworld.com. The Yes Men have a new movie coming out. If you don't know about the Yes Men, I think you're in for a treat. It's quite often easy to get pretty depressed and annoyed when you hear the news that we keep telling you on this show every week. You feel kind of powerless and you feel like you know, they've got us by the short and curlies and we can't do anything about it. Well, the Yes Men do things about it. They do something that they call identity correction. And that is, they go out and basically usurp the identities of various people and organizations, including the political campaign of George W. Bush, including Dow Chemical, Housing and Urban Development, ExxonMobil, Cato, BP, and all kinds of other people. And they basically get out there and pretend to be spokesmen for these organizations and basically set the record straight and have a pretty drastic effect, not just on the level of information that's out there and how aware people are of the news, but also, interestingly, on some of these companies' stock prices and some of these companies' decisions going forward. So, you know, the Yes Men are a very interesting, active group. And Andy Bickelbaum, who's one of the two main characters in that group, along with Mike Bonanno, is going to be joining us tonight to round out the show. So, busy show. As a result of all that, we're going to skip headlines altogether, pretty much, with the exception of one very brief story that I wanted to mention before we get to Shannon, and that is that there's an interesting 9/11 connection here, which I think obviously hasn't been mentioned in the article. This is a New York Times article about cell phone use on airplanes. Apparently, Congress is considering a law to ban cell phone use on planes. Now, planes, people should know, didn't really allow you to use cell phones because of, you know, alleged interference with navigation equipment and electronics on the plane and so on. Before about 2004, you couldn't use them on a plane effectively anyway. If you're anything above a couple of thousand feet, they didn't work. The 9/11 connection, of course, is a lot of alleged phone calls came from cell phone users on the hijacked planes, and one of them, famously, the now deceased, we presume, wife of a former U.S. attorney general, I believe he was, Olson. And there was a couple of very interesting twists in that story. He said he got a call from his wife on the plane saying the plane was hijacked, and the FBI said that no calls ever came from that number at all. And so one of them is lying. Either Ted Olson doesn't know what happened, or someone faked her voice or faked the call, or the FBI is lying about the call because their two stories don't match. Anyway, now foreign airlines have basically implemented technology that allows passengers to use phones on a plane, and the U.S. is considering implementing a law to ban people from using phones on a plane, which is kind of interesting. Anyway, that's kind of all the time we have for headlines, because I want to get to Shannon. Shannon, I mentioned right before you walked in that you were with me when we started this show way back when, the start on the eve of the Iraq War in March of 2003. It's hard to believe it's been 6 years now. Since then, you've moved on to bigger and better things, I'm sure. You did FSRN for a while, and now you're freelancing as a journalist, and you're here in Houston tracking down a story, and I haven't given too much away on that, other than a couple of hints about what it's about. So take us through your timeline. What did you come here looking to I guess, explore?
Well, I'm living in Mexico now, and so I was following a Houston connection to a story that originated in Mexico, specifically having to do with the kidnapping of Central American migrants within Mexican territory and the subsequent trafficking into the U.S. Trafficking, you know, not to be confused with smuggling. Smuggling involves, you know, consent of, yes, I want to go across the border, take me across. And trafficking involves either force, fraud, or coercion, and involving people who were literally kidnapped along the migration routes used by Central Americans and sold into slavery here in Houston. And so I was following that story, and I noticed that I was going to be here during Human Trafficking Awareness Week and thought that was a great opportunity. And I attended one panel discussion that I really kind of opened my eyes to something that I really haven't been paying attention to here in Houston, and that's the issue of domestic trafficking. And that's the same kind of situation where you're working under the conditions of force, fraud, and coercion, not getting paid, or that you're involved in any kind of prostitution under the age of 18. And I came to the realization, spoke with a woman, and the highest risk group for domestic trafficking are teenage runaways. I mean, you can walk down the street from the station and there's, you know, one of the few shelters that's in the city for teenage runaways. Well, if you don't get space at a shelter, where do you go? Turns out within the first 48 hours of running away from home, especially if you are a female, but also if you are a male, within the first 48 hours, you're going to come into contact with either somebody propositioning you or offering to take you in, but take care of you, but eventually pimp you. And I think this is really kind of a forgotten story in the city. And so through the woman that I met, who is a former prostitute, had a drug addiction, she runs a program to help with substance abuse issues to women who have been arrested, who have been in the sex industry, and also to clean out the gunk, really, that the emotional situation that leads to that kind of life decision. I mean, as much of a decision that it is. So she invited me to meet some of the women that she works with, and it kind of led to another story of where Houston is 20 years after the crack epidemic, because a lot of the women that I met, they were in prostitution to fuel a substance abuse problem, most notably crack, and spent more than 20 years doing that here in Houston.
Now, crack kind of disappeared out of the news mostly before I even got here. I've been in the U.S. now about 9 years, mm-hmm. and I missed the big news stories all about crack, and it kind of vanished. So is it still affecting people in ways that we should know about, and where has it gone? Why has the news story died if crack is still a big problem?
Because it's probably not affecting the segment of the population that gets the most press attention. I was here, you know, riding over here on the car, the point was made, well, if it was a lawyer's daughter, if this was happening to a lawyer's daughter, it'd be all over the news, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I've actually, as a freelance journalist, I've been surprised that outlets that don't pay a whole lot, but pay enough to allow you to dig into a story and really follow it for a week or more, rather than just, you know, line up a bunch of interviews and cut it up and, you know, package it. You know, to really let you to do some investigative work, they're just really not interested in it. This isn't the kind of subject matter that they care about or, you know, give value to. But it's still something that's affecting the society. I mean, if I'm talking to women who have just come in off the street and they're just breaking a crack addiction, and they have grown children, and their children were born as, you know, crack babies were all over the news when I was a kid. And those crack babies are young adults now.
Most of these women, are they people of color?
Yes.
Or is that maybe one of the reasons we're not hearing about it?
Well, yeah.
Okay. Just
okay, yeah.
Want to be explicit.
Yeah. I mean,
it's not the lawyer's daughter.
No, it's not the JonBenet Ramsey, or it's not the, Elizabeth Smart was another big case. You know, I heard a statistic that 6,000 kids run away every year in Harris County, and at least a third of them end up in prostitution. So you're talking about 2,000 underage prostitutes just in this county every year. And there are not enough shelters to provide, you know, where are the kids going to sleep? They need a place to go. You need housing. I mean, you can have, you know, even a good programs through the city and stuff, but if you can't take care of where the kid's going to spend the night, I mean, that's not adequate.
No, and it's the, you know, it's the old de Tocqueville thing about you measure the country by how they treat the people at the bottom of the ladder.
How about measuring the media that's supposed to be in public interest, and they just have, you know, that just blows me away. I mean, so, and I'm not saying that as a, you know, I'm not going to get paid for a story kind of thing. It's like, it blows me away that I think this is, you know, this is something that has been a problem in society that we're continuing to deal with. I mean, it's gotten to the point to where we're talking about slavery and the 21st century. And the public radio outlets with a wider audience than FSRN, which has accepted the story, they don't want to hear about it, you know? I guess it's...
You were telling me that you had pitched this to more than one media...
Yeah, I guess it's better to, you know...
And what's the typical reaction that you get if they're not interested? What do they say?
Oh, we did a trafficking story once.
Find us a story on Michael Jackson? Or
8 years ago.
It's almost like they feel like they've covered it, or that the attitude was, well, we've done a trafficking story once. It's like, well, you know, it takes a bunch of different forms.
And I guess the Houston connection is something that hasn't been discussed an awful lot. I mean, a lot of trafficking stories that I hear talk about New Mexico, they talk about, you know, the Rio Grande, but they don't really talk about Houston as a city very much. There's a lot of discussion of Texas, but Houston kind of escapes the spotlight. What do we know about the number of people that get trafficked here, or the number of people that get smuggled here? Do we have any idea on how big, what sort of size we're talking about?
You know, I almost hesitate to say, because it is difficult to document.
Sure.
I put in a request to the U.S. Attorney's Office to get some hard statistics, and they haven't gotten those hard statistics back to me yet, but I have put in a request to be able to...
Well, they may not have them. I mean, if the smuggling is done, you know, obviously it's not above board, and there are probably various people on the take and all sorts of other things involved, and they might not have a real idea themselves.
Well, you know, Houston is actually considered to be a model city as far as combating trafficking goes. There's a really active task force here involving community groups, involving law enforcement. So they probably have a better idea than most other large U.S. cities.
Hmm.
Houston is actually quite a hub, as I'm sure people who listen to this station know. There's, you know, it's a prime connection, not only for the drug market. It's a high-intensity drug trafficking market. Also, most of the weapons that are traceable from Mexico, that are traceable from crime scenes, more of them come from Houston than any other city. So, you know, you have a northward traffic of drugs, you have a southbound traffic of weapons, and what's an extra, let's say, product added to that, to that trade route, are now slaves.
And, of course, the coverage that we're used to seeing here is what's going on in Mexico in the border towns and the drug war and the police connection and the gangs and all of that, but not very much reporting of what's happening north of the border in terms of how it's affecting all the cities that neighbor Mexico, like Houston.
I haven't heard any reports on trafficking except what I've heard from Shannon.
Yeah.
I mean, with all of the talk about what's going on in Juarez, it's all about drugs. No one is discussing these other issues. Even though Juarez was, this, how many, 240 murders over the past 10 years?
Oh, of the women's murders.
Of women, yeah.
Well, I mean, and the thing that's
and we don't even
almost
know what
eclipsing
that, is.
That right now in Juarez is just like the drug murders. I mean, I think, you know.
Well, I mean, it was this mysterious murders of women.
Right.
And we don't know what that was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we don't know what.
There are a lot of theories.
We still don't know. There are a lot of theories.
Yeah.
But mostly we hear about drugs, but we don't hear about this. About humans.
Because I think it's kind of like my friend that I was having some cake with, she mentioned, said this is like old news. It's almost like considered old news. And I think that it's the same thing with the women who are murdered in a really brutal way in Juarez. It's kind of like after the first 100, nobody's paying attention anymore. Same
right.
thing with crack. After the first 20 years, you know, that's old news.
Well, Shannon, we're not going to pay you for the story, unfortunately, because we don't have the budget.
Let me talk about it.
But
that's important.
What I want you to do is follow up with us when you're done, you know, putting it together. And if you have an audio version of it, I'd love to get it on the show here at some point. I don't know what your timeline is for all of this, but we'd love to, you know, get a summary of it when it's done.
You could talk directly to the people that I've spoken with here in Houston.
Okay.
That's where they live.
All right. Well, you have my contact information, so
yeah.
Connect me with them, and we'll do that. And you're obviously welcome to stay in the studio for the rest of the show. We've got John Dean already on the line. We're going to take a very brief break, and we'll be right back with him. But Shannon Young, thanks for dropping by, and always a pleasure to see you.
Thanks for giving me the mic.
All right. This is the Monitor on KPFT in Houston, 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM in Galveston, kpft.org on the World Wide Web. This is Mark Bowie along with Otis McClay and Shannon Young, who may jump in with a question or two. We're not sure. And joining us now live is John Dean. John, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Mark.
It's good to have you back on. John was former counsel to President Nixon for 1,000 days in the government. He was a key witness during the Watergate trials and has just re-released an updated edition of his book, Blind Ambition, which is kind of an autobiographical account of what he saw, what he witnessed, the conversations that he had during that time. And it has a new foreword and a new summary at the end as well. John, why now? Obviously, the story is still fresh in a lot of people's minds, especially with the anniversary of the Pentagon Papers coming up and a new documentary about Ellsberg and so on. What prompted you to re-release this book, and what's in the new segment?
Well, it depends upon the age of the person, whether that memory is active or not. Our collective memory actually is getting a little soft on this subject.
Right.
I think the cusp right now is around 45 years of age. Those 45 and older certainly remember Watergate. Only the precocious and students of it under that age remember it. So I realized this. Yeah, I've been over at USC as a lecturer for a number of years, and I realized the students knew nothing about this period. And when I wrote a book called Worse Than Watergate, they didn't know what I was comparing it against.
Hmm.
Plus, I watched what happened during the Bush-Cheney years and thought, we just need a refresher course of what went on. And I've always been pleased that my account has been held to be as accurate an insider as anybody has ever portrayed those events. So that, plus the fact that there is a school of revisionism that is trying to rewrite what happened during Watergate and during the Nixon years, and I thought that needed to be addressed. Those prompted the reissue with a fairly extensive afterword in which I addressed new information I have discovered when I was forced to sue the revisionists because they wanted to accuse me of being the person responsible for the Watergate break-in. They wanted to drag my wife, who's a total non-combatant and had no knowledge or involvement of Watergate, into it. I said, this is time to take action. And that 9-year lawsuit, which was successfully settled after they spent $15 million trying to fight our lawsuit. They realized that they had a very bad case on their hands. They decided to settle, and I decided to settle because I had enough information and new information after working with a subpoena for 9 years that I could, one, open up a lot of new historical information, and two, I could certainly put to rest the claims of the revisionists.
And some of these people, I mean, I don't know whether it's because people have a short memory or because of the revisionist history that's being, you know, pushed in various places, but, you know, the G. Gordon Liddy's of the world are now somehow, you know, whitewashed and able to continue being in the public eye and to be asked for their opinion on things as though they're somehow qualified and have no history. What do you make of the media's treatment of this story? Has the media totally forgotten about it? Why do they still have people like him on the air at all, do you think?
Again, it depends upon the age of those in the media as to whether they listen with any credibility, give any credibility at all to somebody like Liddy. He clearly has a following. We've known for a long time that the hard right and the Republicans like Liddy as a very real poster boy. They applaud this kind of behavior. They think this is grand. We have the latest iteration of a Gordon Liddy is Joe Wilson, who shouts out in the middle of a joint session of Congress, "You lie,"
mm-hmm.
the president, and they have made him the current poster boy. So yes, there always will be those who like that kind of misbehavior and will applaud it. And why these people on the right do so baffles me, but they do. And I don't really think that anybody, any serious media figures, give anyone like Gordon Liddy and these revisionist accounts any credibility.
Well, I'd put him up there with you know, the Rush Limbaughs of the world in terms of credibility, and not, perhaps not in terms of popularity. So the key lessons, I mean, I think you took the maximum to heart of, you know, those who ignore history are condemned to repeat it, and that's certainly been a lesson that I've learned many times, which is, I guess, puts me in the precocious category because I'm under 45 and I wasn't around when Watergate happened. But for those who don't know the story, and I don't want you to give away too much of the book, obviously, but just give us a very brief thumbnail sketch of what Ellsberg did, what Nixon wanted to do about it, and what the break-ins were all about, just in a couple of minutes, just to give people a taster of the story.
A lot of people don't understand that the bungled burglary that Liddy fumbled so badly and then dumped on the White House's back door with the break-in and the arrest of his men at the Watergate National Committee of the Democrats. What the real cover-up of that, and the reason the White House just didn't cut loose Liddy and the others, was not that the White House was anyway involved in that break-in, but what they had been involved with Liddy before he got over to the re-election committee. And he had broken into Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office after the leak of the so-called Pentagon Papers, trying to look for information about Ellsberg that they could use to discredit him. They found nothing. It was another bungled burglary. But this tracked right back to the White House, to one of the president's most senior aides, John Ehrlichman, if not, and this has never been totally clear, the president himself. Nixon doesn't seem to remember it. Ehrlichman says he talked to the president on the beach in San Clemente about it, but had his blessings for it, but that's just never been clear. But anyway, the reason that Watergate was covered up and the reason that Liddy had such leverage and was able to get the assistance of the White House was that we were horrified this was going to come right back into the White House. Otherwise, I think that John Mitchell, who was the head of his campaign, the president's former attorney general, his deputy Jeb Magruder and Liddy and that entire crowd that authorized these things would have been cut loose, and that would have been the end of the story. They couldn't be cut loose because of the leverage they had on the White House, knowing that the White House had used Liddy for similar purposes. And nobody actually explained that Liddy was the screwball he is. He was, as I reported in the afterward, he was actually eased out of the White House and palmed off on me at one point, not telling me what he was about when I was looking for a general counsel for the reelection committee, because my office had to get rid of a lot of the work we were doing for the reelection committee, the daily minutia of making sure that the president didn't fall through any of the legal cracks you can fall through in all the different states where you have to register and all the processes. But so Liddy was recommended to me, and unbeknownst to me, this guy is a screwball. He thinks he's James Bond, and he really isn't Maxwell Smart. He is just a buffoon, if you will. So Bud Krogh later, who palmed him off on me and was one of the ones who authorized the break-in at Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office, apologized to me for doing that. He recognizes very clearly and has written, too, as I quote in the book, that it's that break-in, it's the entire leaking of the Pentagon Papers that the Nixon White House sort of turns to a dark place. It's really a defining experience in that White House. Frankly, I had tried to leave the Nixon White House in the fall of 71. The Pentagon Papers were leaked in June of 71. I could smell the rot. I was told I couldn't leave. They said, you know, you owe it to us to stay. I'm sure later they wished they'd let me go, but that isn't the way it worked out.
Well, I'm sure they especially now would wish they had let you go so you couldn't write books like this. I have to say, you know, for people who haven't read this or who don't know the story, there are a lot of books out there about Watergate, and there are a lot of various first-hand accounts, most of them horribly self-serving. And not to flatter you, John, but I think yours may be one of the most honest, because you don't seem to make too many passes for yourself about what you were involved in and how it went. Do you feel like you were just too inexperienced at the time to grasp what was really going on, or was it just the pace of it was so fast that you couldn't react as best in the best way possible, or what?
Well, as I explained,
what led you into it?
As I explained in the afterword, you know, that what I really never was ready for and had no training in was the criminal law. I realize now with that particular presidency, it was essential the White House counsel be an experienced criminal lawyer.
Right.
There never had been a criminal lawyer in that post before I got there. I must say, since I've left, every White House counsel's office has had somebody who's very experienced in the criminal law. It's a sad commentary, but obviously a necessary one in the post-Watergate years. But I had never even heard of the crime of obstruction of justice until I started digging around in the statute books, trying to figure out what we were doing, whether it was legal or not, and I realized it's very illegal. And that's when I began telling my colleagues, you know, we're in a whole heap of trouble here. This stuff is... this cover-up it doesn't appear to be national security related, which is a very interesting argument. I was in New York a couple weeks ago for the opening of Ellsberg's new documentary, and he and I were talking about this whole, he said, John, why did Nixon never raise the national security argument? I said, Dan, it's a question that I've never understood. Maybe if his impeachment had gone to trial in the Senate, he would have raised that defense, and we would have had some definition in that trial as to what is legitimate national security and what is not. Because Nixon really did describe, and at one point order me not to discuss the Ellsberg break-in. He said, this is national security. And this is Ehrlichman raised this as a defense when he and Liddy and others were charged with that break-in as violating the civil rights of the doctor whose office they'd broken into.
Mm-hmm.
And the court wrestled with it as well. I mean, you have a rather unorthodox, loosely written, several different Court of Appeals judges all over the lot on whether this is national security or not. So this is a pretty gray area that's, even to this day, as we know, we saw Bush and Cheney slip so many things under the national security label and got away with it.
Well, I was just going to say that was their first line of defense for any issue, whether it was, whistleblower Sybil Edmonds, for example, from the FBI. We've had her on the show a couple of times, and every time she tried to say anything, including to the 9/11 Commission itself, she was basically gagged by national security orders, and that appears to have been the Bush administration's first line on anything. We want to know who's visited the White House to discuss energy policy. Well, no, that's national security issue. Yeah, and it worked, which I guess was kind of what led you to write Worse Than Watergate, which we had you on to talk about. And I want to in a few minutes we have left to talk about somebody else's book, unfortunately, because I watched you on Keith Olbermann's show talking about some of the things that are in Tom Ridge's book, and it struck me that not only is a little bit of revisionism going on with Tom Ridge in terms of his own role and maybe trying to give himself an out.
Revisionism going from his book to his promotion tour.
Right. Yeah, well, exactly. Some of the things he's saying on tour are not consistent with what is written in the book. But tell people a little bit about this. I'm not suggesting for a minute that they go out and read Tom Ridge's book or even buy it, but the summary of the story, and we talked about it at the time, is that Homeland Security basically appeared to have a very interesting connection with the White House, where the threat level would go up at various times when it was politically expedient, and it affected the president's approval rating several times. Now, Ridge is saying that he was feeling some pressure from the White House to do these things, but that he somehow resisted. And
he describes a conversation at a very crucial time just before the election of a call from Rumsfeld and Ashcroft being in a national security hookup with them, where they are arguing to raise the level. And Ridge is saying, well, you know, he's saying, and he's speculating in his book that this is being done not because there's any intelligence that justifies it, but it's being done for political reasons. He indicates this is one of the reasons he resigns from the post. When he's out, after this is leaked early, and when I'm first confronted with this, I hear it from Olbermann citing it just directly as Ridge writes it in the book.
Mm-hmm.
When Olbermann asked me about it, I said, you know, if that's true, that's a criminal offense. This is one of the laws that so many got caught on in Watergate, where if you conspire, two people get together and take an overt step to manipulate the government or any agency of government to do an action which is not in its normal function or for political purposes, that is a crime. It violates a specific statute, a conspiracy statute. And Ridge, as a former U.S. attorney, I would have thought would have had his antenna up for that very thing, but might not have. You never know. And afterwards, when I started raising these issues, and others did as well, Ridge backed right down and claimed that people were misinterpreting what he said. He softened the remarks. Rumsfeld denied it. Ashcroft denied it. So the whole thing that he's written has been already revised and softened to the charge that those of us who watched this process and believe that there was indeed a use of fear-mongering by changing threat levels and their colors to stir people up and make them more anxious before the election, which was patent at times. We don't have a confirmation from Ridge on this point, at least.
Well, I don't know if you caught Tom Ridge on The Daily Show. But John Stewart said, who are you and what have you done with Tom Ridge? So even John Stewart was keenly aware that the things that Ridge was saying in relation to his book were not kind of backed up by the history. And there was one very key example where the threat level was raised just before the Democratic convention, and there was no evidence to support raising it. It was four-year-old wiretap stuff that had nothing to do with anything current. So, yeah, there's certainly some stuff there. My co-host, Otis McClay, has a question for you.
Just a question. You mentioned in the article that there were some witnesses. Do you know if anything's been done to pursue that?
Tom Ridge describes that. When I actually looked at the text of the book, I didn't buy the book, but today with Amazon, you can get a pretty good hunk of a book if you just want to look at any section. I just ran an index check, and sure enough, on that page, he's describing this whole activity. He describes his the aides that are there with him, and I said, well, in writing the article, I said, well, if this is true, we can find out what Ridge said is or is not, and I suggested some enterprising journalist might follow up on this. I have been off and about, and I'm not really a journalist. I'm a columnist. There is a difference. And I've not had a chance to follow up on it. But I've suggested that somebody should.
You haven't heard that anybody's done it, though.
No, I haven't. I haven't either. I try and keep an eye out for it.
Interesting.
To date, nobody has.
Well, I'm afraid, actually, we're pretty much out of time, but I wanted to squeeze in one last question, if I could, John, and that is on the torture issue. The current investigation by the Department of Justice basically is looking at some people who carried out interrogations who may have overstepped the lines of the practices that outlined by the White House for them, rather than investigating, you know, the White House and the National Security Council for authorizing these torture techniques in the first place. What do you think the Obama administration's tack is on this ultimately, and in legal terms, what could be done to the people who came up with the policy rather than simply carried out the policy?
Well, as you know, because you mentioned it in our email exchange, I wrote a column on this very subject when I ran into a book written by Sam Huntington, a former professor from Harvard of political science, which I think really hits this subject just right on. So first, since we have a little bit of time, I suggest people go to my Fine Law column, which is expert advice on this very subject. I don't have it on my screen right now, but
The title of the column is Expert Advice on Dealing with a Prior Administration's Use of Torture, and I'll give the link to the website when we wrap up.
Great. Well, that just, to me, summarizes the problems. It has the pro, the reasons people would pursue a prosecution, and it has the reasons one wouldn't. I happen to come down and embrace those that would call for an investigation. But even the compromise position this administration doesn't seem to be taking, which is to at least make sure there is full disclosure. I'm not even sure we're going to get that.
Right.
This review that is now going on of some middle-level people is not exactly going to be an exposure of what went on, why it went on, and who all was involved. Why Obama has backed down on this, I have written an earlier column that it looks to me like he's been captured by the national security community, and he's playing to that group because he needs them to govern.
It's unfortunate, and you know, if things don't resolve themselves in the next within the administration this first term, because I don't know if he'll get a second, I would encourage you to write a new book, maybe Liberals Without a Conscience. I don't know if that's on the cards or not, because you know, the guys you write about as conservatives without conscience are not real conservatives, and if these people in the administration today don't do what they're supposed to do, then they're not real liberals either.
It'll be very disappointing.
Yeah. Well, John, thanks a lot for joining us, and John's articles and all of his recent works, including the two that we mentioned today specifically, can be found at the Find Law website. That is findlaw.com. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Bye, Mark.
Thank you. That was John Dean. He's a former counsel to President Nixon. His new book, or re-released version of an older book, is called Blind Ambition. It's a good read. We'll take a very brief break right now, and we'll be right back with Andy Bickelbaum from The Yes Men. Stay tuned. This is the Monitor on KPFT in Houston. You are tuned to 90.1 FM if you're in Houston, and of course 89.5 FM in Galveston, kpft.org on the World Wide Web. This is Mark Vowey along with Otis McClay and Shannon Young, and joining us now live is Andy Bickelbaum of the Yes Men. Andy, welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks a lot.
It's good to have you on. I don't know if you remember, I had you on, I think it was about 3 years ago maybe, and we talked about something else, and you are now with the Yes Men releasing a new movie, which we want to talk about, and it's called The Yes Men Fix the World. But before we do that, I just want to run through a couple of Yes Men history pieces for people to get to know who you are. I was saying at the top of the show that shows like this can be kind of depressing because you hear a lot of bad news and you don't get a lot of ideas about what you can do about this bad news. But you and your co-members of the Yes Men have done various things. Run us through a couple of them. Let's start with, I guess, probably the most famous one, which was when I talked to you last about Dow Chemical. This is back in 2004, I think.
Yeah. What we did for that was set up a fake website that looked a lot like the real website of Dow Chemical Corporation, but was a little too honest about their past. And their past includes, of course, the Bhopal catastrophe. Biggest industrial disaster in history took place in 1984. A poorly maintained chemical plant exploded, killing 20,000 people in India. And the company that owned the plant was Union Carbide. And it never really compensated the survivors or cleaned up the site of the plant. And fast forward 20 years to 2002, Dow Chemical buys Union Carbide and accepts its liabilities in the U.S., compensates some asbestos claimants in Texas, but refuses to do anything about the outstanding problems in India. And so a friend of ours who was working on this issue approached us and said, oh, you guys should do something about this. And so we set up this website, this fake website, and issued a press release announcing that Dow was going to do the right thing. In 2002, first thing we did was issue a press release announcing that Dow would never do the right thing because Bhopalis would never be shareholders. And it got a little bit of press, just one or two articles, but that was enough to get it noticed by search engines. And then when people would search on Dow, they'd sometimes stumble on our site by accident. And that happened to the BBC on the 20th anniversary of the Bhopal catastrophe on December 3rd, 2004, or a week before that. And they contacted what they thought was Dow and asked them if they would appear on the BBC on the 20th anniversary of the catastrophe and say why they wouldn't take responsibility for the disaster or, you know, just express themselves. And we were thrilled and said, actually, we have a really huge announcement, and you're going to be thrilled. And on the 20th anniversary, I went into the Paris studios of the BBC and announced to the world that Dow was doing the right thing. We were taking full responsibility for the Bhopal catastrophe, finally. We were going to liquidate Union Carbide that we had bought and use the proceeds to compensate the survivors, clean up the site, and otherwise do good. And for about an hour, the world believed that was the case. And then, of course, the truth came out, was a hoax. And an interesting thing that happened during that 1 hour when the world believed that Dow was doing the right thing in Bhopal is the stock market punished Dow, lopped like $2 billion off its value for that 1 hour, and then it all came back. So that was a really interesting lesson to us on, you know, what the priorities of the market system really are.
Right. I was just talking with my co-host right before we got you on, and I was you know, giving him some of this history, and that was his immediate reaction, that if you do the right thing, if the company acts morally and takes responsibility for its previous errors, the stock market punishes it for doing that rather than rewards it, which obviously is shows you that the stock market is completely upside down.
So but the short sellers made money, don't
sure,
you yourself.
Sure, no, a lot of people probably made money on that, but, you know, it's a very interesting story, and, you know, the BBC was fooled, and you're not the first guest, actually, I've had on who's been fooled by fake websites. Investigative reporter Greg Palast has been on, and he set up a fake George W. Bush website, and various Republican people sent all sorts of insider email details about what the campaign was up to. And so that's it's a good trick, and if people out there want to do that, that's something you can certainly get up to. Now, as a history of the Yes Man, you've now taken this and a couple of other stories, and you're releasing this new movie. Tell us a little bit about it. This is The Yes Men Fix the World. What's the key part of the story for this, and when can people go see it?
Well, as if by coincidence, it starts with the BBC appearance that I just described.
Mm-hmm.
That's the beginning of the movie where, you know, we do this thing and the stock market reacts. You know, we start out doing this thing, and this is sort of reality as well. We started doing this thing thinking, well, Dow could do the right thing. If only, you know, let's just push this company to have a conscience. It's like what so many liberals think, you know, let's just make these companies think. Let's get to the CEOs and make them really, you know, do the right thing. If they know how bad what they're doing is, they'll do the right thing. So we, you know, we start out, okay, let's start out with that premise. And we go and we announce to the world that Dow is going to do the right thing. You know, it's a hint to Dow, hey, you could just do this. This is the right thing. And the stock market punishes Dow, which, you know, is kind of the crux of the movie. You can't expect companies to do the right thing. You can't expect CEOs to do the right thing because they'll be fired if they do the right thing because they'll lose a bunch of money. So the only solution is to really change the rules of the game and have the bottom line no longer be just pure profit, but also good for society. And so we go on and we do other actions, other pranks, more and more outrageous, more and more crazy. At one point we inflate a giant 6-foot grub suit that we say is going to save managers from climate calamity. At another point we and we're doing that as Halliburton at an insurance conference. At another point we hand out, as Exxon, to a bunch of oil people, we hand out these candles that we say are made of we announce to them after they're holding them and burning them that the candles are a prototype of Exxon's solution to climate change, which is to turn all the people who die from climate change into fuel to keep the whole machine running. And they're burning these things, and they understand that,
wow,
oh, they're made of human flesh. Oh, shit.
Ned, what's the reaction that, other than the, you know, total shock when people figure out that you're
well,
doing,
were they
things
shocked? That's my first question.
Well, at that point they were. Yeah,
okay.
I mean, there was the holding human flesh was the limit. We found nothing else. I mean, they you know, another conference they were looking at these big round suits that we call survivaballs, and they thought it was Halliburton saying that this survivaball is the way to solve climate problems. You know, just if everything goes to pot, the richest people can survive in these things. And for that, they just sat there and applauded and asked polite questions. But yeah, when they were holding human flesh, they reacted. They took us off to the holding cell underneath the stadium, and the police arrived about an hour later and just laughed.
Well, you are actually just recently arrested. And this is, you know, one of the things that kind of made me want to get you on again, because you and the, not because you got arrested, but because of the story that preceded it. You and the Yes Men distributed throughout New York City, and I talked about this last week. You had 2,000 volunteers, and you distributed a 32-page special edition, a fake special edition, of course, of the New York Post, with the front cover in a huge headline saying "We're screwed," and it's basically talking about what's going to happen to New York if climate change continues on the course that it's continuing. Tell us a little bit about that as well.
Well, it's a bunch of real news. It's a 32-page edition of the New York Post that actually communicates the news. The New York Post is this right-wing tabloid in New York that's mostly gossip and car ads and stuff like that, and a little bit of opinionated politics, but not very much. And we thought, well, we would produce a version of this newspaper, but which has a wonderful style. It's, they've got great headline writers. They've got this really populist kind of direct language that they can be very clever. We would do all that, but we would actually communicate information. And so everything in it is either breaking news or vastly underreported news about climate change. And how dire it'll be. And it's very simple to explain how dire it'll be. You can explain it to a five-year-old. So we just used this very simplistic format and did that and made a very amusing 32-page paper and distributed it throughout Manhattan. And people would read through it and think it was a real post and probably learn a lot. The UN reacted and liked it. And Rupert Murdoch was handed a copy, actually the owner of the Post and mm-hmm. all of the News Corp, you know, Fox and everything. He was handed a copy, and as if by coincidence, 20 minutes later, two of the distributors were arrested by police in front of the building, and the copies impounded. I wasn't one of them. I was arrested the next day for something completely unrelated. We launched a flotilla of survivaballs at the UN. We announced that we were going to send these 20-25 survivaballs to the UN and refuse to move and basically blockade the negotiators inside the room until they came up with a smart climate agreement. which is basically the goal of the Secretary General of the UN.
Well, that's what that's what they should be doing at the UN, but they're not quite as forceful as that.
No, but well, I mean, Ban Ki-moon has said in no uncertain terms that leaders have to come up with an agreement. He's been extremely clear about the dangers facing the world and just how forceful we have to be.
Well, he said just recently, I think it was about 10 days ago, that he thought world leaders needed shock therapy in order to understand the scale of the problem.
Yeah.
And I don't know that they have, and I'm hoping that, Ban Ki-moon aside, the UN as an organization currently on this issue hasn't been nearly as strident as it should be. And for people who are not sure about the survivable story.
Where it gets its money.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Sure.
You really need to consider that when you talk about the UN.
Sure. Sure. But for people who don't know, you mentioned the survivaball a couple of times. Just tell people a little bit about what that is exactly. It's a costume posing as a living system?
Yeah. Again, this is the thing that we unveiled at an insurance conference in Florida to a bunch of insurance people, to a bunch of lawyers and insurance executives. And they thought they were watching Halliburton, and we said, well, climate change, as we all know here on the Gulf Coast, can be terrible, and, we can have a lot of destruction, and it could maybe, even mean the obliteration of civilization if scientists are right and we don't do something quickly. But it's okay. We at Halliburton have the solution. We can turn lemons into lemonade as long as we survive. And these suits here, and we inflated these three suits, two of which were being worn by lawyers in the audience. We can put the richest of the rich in these suits, and they will survive to continue running their companies even if everyone else dies. And that's when people just applauded. So after that, we manufactured 20, 30 of them. And have been using them in various forms of civil disobedience actions. They're really good for blockading places. Security guards don't know what to do with them.
They probably make you a bit too large to grab, I guess.
Yeah, and you don't know what part is what, so no.
And that's what led to summons and tickets for disorderly behavior outside the UN.
I mean, we basically created the spectacle where we announced that we were going to swim in the East River with these survivaballs all the way to the UN and blockade the delegates inside until they came to an agreement. Of course, once we were in the water about 5 feet out, the police arrived en masse, or gunboats and Coast Guard and even a helicopter with a commando leaning out the side. And you can see all this on the CNN video that they made. And the cops arrived also by land, and we left. We decided we didn't want to hurt them, so we retreated. These are very, well-defended survivaballs. Of course, they have armaments, and they can fend off the the tidal wave of humanity that'll result as people migrate from areas that are drought-stricken or famine-stricken. So they're very well armed. We could have taken down the police, but we decided not to. We didn't want to hurt anybody, so we left the water. And the police asked for IDs from about 7 people, including myself. I stupidly gave them ID, and they found I had an outstanding bicycle warrant. procedure in New York, they took me to the basement.
So you were arrested for an outstanding bicycle warrant.
I'm afraid so.
Well, you've since been released. That's the good news.
There have been some good people arrested for bicycle problems. I mean, you know, has a history. It's not like...
A lot of them.
Now, the subtitle of the movie, and this is, you know, I guess the central theme of the Yes Men, is that it says, sometimes it takes a lie to expose the truth.
Yeah.
There's a lot of good therapy with this, Andy. You're not the only person we've had on who makes people laugh in spite of their pain. What keeps you going, and what do you see for the future of the Yes Men beyond this movie? And it starts screening this next week, right?
Yeah, it's screening October 7th in New York City, and then October 23rd it'll go nationwide. I think there's a theater in Houston, and there might be one in Dallas. I'm a little fuzzy on that, but it is going nationwide October 23rd. And it's a really funny movie. You know, what keeps us going is laughing. We just laugh all the time when we do these things, and enjoy it tremendously. It's a great way to, you know, pass a week or two, and better than an ordinary vacation. And
I'm sure you meet all sorts of interesting people as well.
Oh, lots, you know, yeah. And the people at these conferences are perfectly nice. They're just in a demonic system, but they're nice themselves. There's nothing unpleasant about hanging out with them.
Well, for people who want more information, you should go to theyesmenfixtheworld.com, and you'll see all sorts of information there about screenings. You can even watch a high-definition trailer of the movie. Andy, we have 1 minute left. What do you want to leave us with before we let you go?
Oh, gosh. Well, maybe I'll answer your question. Where we've been going recently is trying to think of how to be effective. And so we've launched a website. We've in collaboration with a lot of direct action activists. It's beyondtalk.net, and you can go there and sign up, pledge to perform civil disobedience in the interest of and risk arrest in the interest of getting our leaders to make the right climate change decisions. It's the only way things have changed in America, and they've got to change now.
Well, I just logged on to the website when you mentioned it, beyondtalk.net. Tired of hearing about climate change, then do something. And there is some links there that people can get to act, take the pledge. And there is also a link for resources so they can get a little bit more information on the topic.
That's right.
Well, that's all the time we have. But, Andy, thanks so much for joining us and for informing and entertaining and educating people while being funny at the same time. I appreciate your efforts.
Thank you, guys.
Keep up the good work.
Okay.
And pay those outstanding bicycle tickets so you can get arrested next time. Okay, thanks. Thanks a lot. Okay, that was Andy Bickelbaum from The Yes Men. The website, once again, is theyesmenfixtheworld.com for news of the movie. Go to beyondtalk.net that Andy just mentioned now to get involved in civil disobedience if you don't mind risking getting arrested. And there are also some resources and action links on there. Before that, we had John Dean, former White House counsel. And before that, we had Shannon Young, former co-host of this show and current journalist, following a story. Shannon, we'll get that from you when you finish it. Wrap it up, right?
Yeah.
All right, that's all the time we have. Todd Simmons engineered the show. Otis McClay is my co-host. Shannon was visiting us for the week. We'll be back with you next week at 7. Good night.
Listeners support KPFT in many different ways. Some write checks and others use credit cards. But if you're spinning your wheels looking for a tax deduction, think about donating your working but unwanted car, motorcycle, boat, or truck to KPFT. You'll qualify for a tax deduction and at the same time take care of that unfinished business. To make a donation, call our toll-free vehicle donation hotline at 877-308-2408. We'll arrange for your vehicle to be picked up and the title transfer. Then we'll send you a receipt for your tax deduction. It's that simple to support the station you've come to rely on. Patreon for alternative music, news, and public affairs programming. Again, for more information or to make a donation, call our toll-free vehicle donation hotline at 877-308-2408. You're tuned in to commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston, radio for peace.
Yo, what's up?
It's
I'ma kick it with mine, y'all know.
It's
Slim, can I kick it right now? Here we go.
It's
time to make that change. People of the world today are fading. All of us have our ups and downs. You better think about it or you won't be around. What we need is a little bit of love. Sent by one from heaven up above. Take a picture, it's simple and plain. This ain't no game, you know what I'm saying. What?
It's time.
Yep, yep.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.